Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. What a gorgeous Saturday, particularly. We're going to be talking about a number of topics this week relating to Thanksgiving. Even if you were Americans or traveling, many still are, and we'll be talking about that through the prism of COVID-19 restrictions and some of the positive news that we're getting as well, particularly with yet another vaccine with a positive phase 3 clinical trial. You just heard as well on NPR Top of the Hour News about President-elect Biden and his choices for his cabinet subject to senatorial confirmation. We're going to be talking about the individuals whose names were released today. But we begin with the very latest on COVID-19. Here in Southern California, we're seeing increasing restrictions, some of which went into effect Saturday and Sunday. And on Wednesday night, we expect in Los Angeles County a brand new restriction, which stops all in-person dining at LA County restaurants. Outdoor dining, which has been allowed, will no longer be allowed, and that's for a minimum three-week period of time. A little bit later this hour, we'll open up the phones for restaurant owners and for listeners to comment on that restriction, hear what you think about it. But we begin with the latest overall news on COVID-19 with UCLA Fielding School of Public Health Professor of Epidemiology and Community Health Sciences, Dr. Robert Kim Farley. Dr. Kim Farley, so good to have you with us again.
It's good to be back on your program. Nice to be with you.
Let's talk first about the good news from the Oxford AstraZeneca trial. This is now the third straight we've had in a couple of weeks, which indicates around 90% effectiveness rate in the case of the AstraZeneca for those that have the two-shot protocols. This looks like we're going to have multiple vaccines to choose from.
Yes, you know, this is really the light at the end of the tunnel, I think, for all of us hunkering down, wearing masks, and trying to avoid crowds, is that we just wait a bit longer and we will have these products available. And as you just rightly pointed out, the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine is also very promising. Hundreds of millions of doses expected in January or February. And it's much cheaper, about $2.50 a dose compared to about $20 a dose for the Pfizer vaccine. And it can be stored at regular temperatures in refrigerators. So this is going to be a great vaccine, especially in the developing world as well.
Is there going to be a decision for people to make about which one of the vaccines to seek out?
Well, I think what will happen is that as these vaccines are going to be in limited supply, logistics will be made so that, for example, the Pfizer vaccine, it requires a very cold temperature, -70 degrees centigrade, 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Those require special storage containers, so not every place is going to be able to receive and hold that type of vaccine. So that people are in areas in which they have such facilities, they may be getting the Pfizer vaccine, but others will be using other storage facilities and that can be used for the Moderna vaccine, for example. So I think basically the bottom line, the best vaccine for you is the one that you can get. So I think that's going to be the reality.
So you don't think the difference in technologies that, you know, one type might match up with a particular patient profile better than another, you don't think it's going to get to that level of specifics?
Yeah, I don't think so. Certainly at the very beginning here, when it's going to be in such short supply, we need to get these vaccines to our frontline healthcare workers, to those people who are working in and patients in nursing home facilities, which have had high rates of death, and then especially to other people who are elderly, have pre-existing medical conditions, things like this. These are going to be our high priority groups for the first vaccines, and I think it's going to be important just getting a vaccine into them. Once we get into the summer of next year, we got plenty of vaccines and different types of vaccines available. We may be able to talk about subtleties of which vaccines might be best for which people. But I think at this stage, again, the best vaccine is the one that you can actually get.
Dr. Robert Kim Farley, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, with us. He served as LA County Department of Public Health Director of Communicable Disease Control and Prevention, also a former senior official with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization. If you have questions for Dr. Kim Farley, we're at 866-893 KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We are seeing increasing numbers of cases and hospitalizations in California. According to the Los Angeles Times, there are over 5,000 hospitalized patients with a confirmed case of COVID-19. That's up 78% from 2 weeks ago, but we were down in a much better place a couple of weeks ago as well. We're still well off of the high that we had late July, early August. Dr. Kim Farley, I'm wondering, with the advances that we've made in treating people with COVID-19, even with this increase in positive test results, is it more likely now that we're going to avoid our hospitals being overcrowded because we do know better how to treat people who are sick?
Well, I think that the answer to that is a bit complex in the sense that we are seeing lots of different aspects of this disease because of the fact that we are now seeing, you know, three times the number of cases that we were seeing in California than we were just back in October of this year. We're now at over 11,500 cases a day. These numbers are going to challenge our hospital systems. Now, in terms of the number of deaths, we have not seen the same amount of deaths with these number of cases previously. This is lower, but that's probably because, again, a number of factors. One is that younger people are now getting the disease, so it's spreading down lower ages, and that group has less severity and death rate than those who are older. We also, as you rightly pointed out, Larry, have now some tools in our armamentarium, if you will, to fight COVID-19. Regeneron, which is the monoclonal antibody. You've got this dexamethasone, which is a steroid that can be used. We have remdesivir, which is an antiviral drug. All of these things can be brought to bear, which will also reduce the number of deaths. But some of these treatments have to be applied in the hospital, so it still doesn't solve our problem of potentially increasing and overloading our hospital systems.
Dr. Robert Kim Farley with us, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. He joins us regularly to talk about the latest on COVID-19. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Ethan in Mid-City LA wonders what the difference in technology is between the Oxford AstraZeneca one that we got the results on today and the Pfizer and the Moderna ones that we got information on a number of days ago.
Ethan asks a very good question. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are using a technology very new, using messenger RNA, mRNA, that basically goes into the cells and then makes our own cells create these spike-like proteins that are then our immune system can respond to, so that when we actually were exposed to COVID, we would have immunity to it. The AstraZeneca vaccine, however, is using a technology in the past we've used for the idea of a more attenuated type of virus. This is a cold-like virus that has, though, these protein spikes that are on the COVID virus, so that when we get the vaccine, it basically then mimics, if you will, those spikes on the COVID. Again, our immune systems are activated to respond to that, and then we'll be able to develop the antibody that will protect us when we ever got exposed to COVID.
Denise, in Santa Monica, I understand you participated in the AstraZeneca trial?
Yes, that's right, Larry. I still am in it. I went for a flu shot about 8 weeks ago, and the next day I felt really ill. In fact, I thought, oh, no, I've got COVID. And then I remembered, no, you've got the flu shot. And then, of course, I got better. Then I had volunteered for the AstraZeneca trial, and I went to get that first shot and had no reaction at all, nothing. Like, I didn't even have a red spot on my arm. And I said to my kids, oh, I got the placebo. I'm 71, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I went back for my checkup this past Wednesday, my tech, I told him that, and he just laughed, and he said, everybody says that. Everybody in the trial says, I must have gotten the placebo. And we know that 66% are getting the vaccine. Two out of every three people we see are getting the vaccine. So I just thought...
Yeah. So that's great news. If what the tech told you is an accurate reflection of those in the trial, that's very good to know, Denise. And of course, you don't know yet, right?
I don't know yet which one I got, but he did say, they called and said, by the way, if you've heard the news, there's vaccines coming out, and we know that you might want to get another vaccine, and you can drop out of this at any time, and we're going to be unblinding who got what.
Okay, so you'll be finding out soon. Denise, thank you so much. Appreciate your sharing that. Bob Kim Farley, your thoughts about Denise and what the tech told her that everybody thought, because they didn't have any reaction on their arm, that they were getting the placebo.
First, I just want to thank Denise for calling in and sharing that experience, because I think that, again, although we do not know if she received a placebo or the vaccine, the fact that the technician mentioned that, you know, people were not getting reactions, I think is really strongly indicative. Again, this vaccine is going to be a good vaccine. It's not going to have a lot of side effects, and this is what we need to build people's confidence about taking vaccine. I also wanted just to commend Denise for the fact that she did get her flu shot, and I would like to, again, remind your listenership that, you know, this is the time to make sure, if you haven't already gotten your flu shot, to do so. The last thing we need is to have people flooding our hospitals with influenza at the same time we have this spike going on now with the COVID-19.
Ronaldo tweets at AirTalk, my girlfriend is pregnant and due in June of 2021. She works in healthcare. How will the vaccine affect the pregnancy and the baby?
Yes. The vaccines that have been tested so far have not actually been tested for pregnant women. So probably she will not be one offered at this stage until they've had some more thorough studies of that. They've been trying to just get people of all ages and also of different race and ethnicities to make sure that it can be widely used, but they have not targeted pregnant women for these tests yet.
Yeah, and Jenica also asked about nursing mothers. I assume the same thing, that it has not been tested for mothers who are nursing.
Well, some of these are, since they are not live virus vaccine, should not be a problem for nursing mothers.
Oh, okay.
But that's a good point that, you know, there may be some vaccines in the future that would not be recommended. But usually vaccines are not a problem for that type of a transmission.
We have listener Tom in Claremont. If you're vaccinated, do you still have the ability to spread the virus?
That is the $64,000 question. We don't know yet. We have different examples of vaccines. For example, like with polio, you have inactivated polio vaccine that protects the individual. But if that individual got infected with polio, although they're protected, they could shed the polio virus to other people. Whereas oral polio vaccine that we also use protects not only the individual themselves, but puts antibodies into the gut because it's taken orally in the intestines. And so, therefore, if they get exposed to polio, they will not excrete it and will not be a source of transmission to others. So we don't know yet in terms of, will these vaccines not only protect the individual at this 90% or 95% efficacy, will it also prevent and stop transmission? But in any case, ultimately, if we can get the herd immunity levels, the 60 or 70% of community immunity, with everybody having that type of immunity, the virus will die out.
Okay. So that's the guarantee when you get to that level of herd immunity. And you said that would be 60 to 70% of people vaccinating?
Yes, Larry.
Okay. And at this point, you know, I've heard conjecture that by the end of spring, there could be enough vaccine available for everybody willing to take it to have it. Do you think that's a realistic timeline?
Well, it is conjecture. If I look into my crystal ball, I think that we will see, again, by the end of this year, doses for, again, the health care workers that are, you know, putting their lives at risk here on the front lines, and then followed quickly by that with our persons in the nursing homes that are at high risk, and then other high-risk individuals that are elderly or have pre-existing medical conditions, then our essential workers. And then finally, it will get down to if anyone who wants it can have it. That probably is toward the late spring, and I would probably expect even into summer before a really young person, healthy and has no pre-existing conditions, would make sure that they have access as well. But it probably will be early summer before that happens.
All right. Sounds so it's not going to help necessarily for spring semester for students. We're talking with Dr. Robert Kim Farley, UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, professor of epidemiology and community health sciences. We're taking your questions at 866-893-KPECC. I was looking at a national story, Dr. Kim Farley, about there being an abundance of ventilators for the most seriously ill COVID patients, but not enough of the specialists who have training in operating the ventilators to be able to have all the machines operational. Do you know here in Southern California if that's an issue as it is in other parts of the country, or is this largely a rural shortage?
Good question, Laura. Let me just one thing follow up on your previous one about not happening for spring for our students.
Yeah.
The one thing is that we can keep in mind that by fall of next year, we will be able to definitely be going back to school. We will be able to start, living our lives much more normally because of the vaccine being available. So, again, I want to emphasize that light at the end of the tunnel for everyone. If they'll just hunker down and wear your masks and hang in there with physical distancing. Respectfully, though, with talking about the ventilator issue, we probably have sufficient numbers of ventilators now. There's something like 150,000 now in the national strategic stockpile. There was a number of manufacturers that geared up to make additional ventilators available. But you've just hit your nail on the head there that we don't necessarily have the number of people to run them. These are intensivists, pulmonologists, technicians that are respiratory technicians. So that is also a problem that exists, especially more in rural areas where they may not have a hospital intensivist. And so that may be the problem. But that will probably result in some people having to just be transferred into urban areas. But that then just complicates our problem of our urban hospitals, potentially becoming overloaded. So the problem is not so much the number of ventilators anymore, which it was at the beginning, but it's the number of people who can operate them. And I think also we've learned something else along the way, that at the beginning we put a lot of people on ventilators right away with concerned about their health. But now we've learned a number of things. We talk about proning, which is the idea of putting a person on their stomach, that improves breathing, and so we can hold off on doing a ventilator. We've also found that some of the simpler methods of just delivering nasal oxygen or this CPAP masks on people rather than going to full ventilator can also be very helpful. So I think that those combined will also help us to not have to need as many ventilators, but it's really the issue of the people to run the ventilators when they are needed.
We'll continue by focusing on Los Angeles County's ban starting Wednesday night on all in-person dining. That means all these restaurants that have invested in outdoor heating, pavilion-style coverings, are going to find that for naught because all outdoor dining now in L.A. County will cease for a minimum of 3 weeks. We're going to talk with Jot Condi of the California Restaurant Association, and we're going to hear from Dr. Bob Kim Farley about what he thinks of taking this step. Is there science that really justifies taking such a step that's going to financially devastate so many restaurants? Does this match with where we're really seeing the spread of COVID-19? We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk.